the interview was talking about Al-Qaeda cells operating in South Africa, in Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Durban. Are the police aware of that, and what is the impact to our country?
Thank you, Chair. I think you're referring to the initial publications was in the Daily Maverick about some activities that's going on. A lot of the information reflected in that report referred to events that took place quite some time ago. But I can maybe just mention as well that the Minister for State Security, Dr. Siyabonga Kwele, with the budget speech, made some reference to it, and I can maybe just quote what he said in the newspapers. State Security Minister Siyabonga Kwele says, counterterrorism agents in the State Security Agency are building a solid case against South Africans suspected of having links with terrorist groups. Kwele told a media briefing the agency has last year received information that some brothers and sisters are linked to terrorist groups such as Al-Shabaab. He said he was confident of arrest and that South Africa was committed to fighting terrorism anywhere it occurs. So, Chair, I would say it seemed to me this is a matter that's receiving attention on intelligence level. And in that regard, I don't really have information with me to share. But I think what has been said by the Minister for State Security, this issue is receiving attention at a high level. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, when it comes to the security of the country, nobody can really be against that. So I will say that let us approve this because it's the security of the country.
Honorable Matina.
Chair, approve.
I agree, Chair. Thank you very much. Honorable Bloom, we don't form a quorum. We will approve in the next meeting. And we form a quorum. You can continue with the briefing on the dangerous purpose bill.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, just to go somewhat into the history, the Dangerous Weapons Act, as it is at the moment, is one of the pieces of legislation that had not yet been rationalized. In that sense, there are different acts that are applicable in the different parts of South Africa, the old, what they call the TBDC states, as well as in the rest of South Africa. Now, there was a court case, the judgment in the matter of State versus Tunzi and Mlonzi in the Eastern Cape, Ntata. The court declared the applicability of Section 4 of the Dangerous Weapons Act, which is still applicable in the Transkei region, unconstitutional, and referred the matter to the Constitutional Court for confirmation. Section 4 actually dealt with issues relating to sentencing. In terms of that regulations, there were a different sentencing regime in the Transkei, and that was found unconstitutional. And for that reason, the court said, but in any way, the act need to be rationalized in order that you will have one set of legislation that will be applicable to the whole country. Chair, the specific notice regarding the sentences was already withdrawn by the Minister of Justice, so that issue has been rectified in that manner. And in terms of the government notice, the provisions of Section 4, 1 and 2 of the Dangerous Weapons Act, which was declared to be applicable to the former Republic of the Transkei, was withdrawn on the 10th of November 2010 to give effect to the Constitutional Court declaration. Chair, as I've said, the Constitutional Court called for the rationalisation of the Dangerous Weapons Act applicable in South Africa as well as in the former TBDC states. It should be noted that the Constitutional Court did not declare the contents of the Act except for the notice relating to sentencing in particular areas as unconstitutional. Chair, however, we accept that the Act was adopted as far back as 1968. and that it's important to review the contents thereof in terms of present policing needs as well as policing issues and, of course, the constitution that we need to take into account. The Constitutional Court required the Speaker of the National Assembly, the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, and the Minister of Justice to notify the Court of the legislative steps taken in fulfillment of the above. So, Chair, once this legislation is finalized, we will report back to the Constitutional Court to say what has happened. Chair, as we said, the Dangerous Weapons Act is outdated, and this necessitated the drafting of a new act, a bill. The bill takes into account the constitutional principles, and it accounts for dangerous weapons account for a huge number of violent crimes committed in the country. It should, however, be kept in mind that this is, in essence, not the use of a weapon in an offence that needs to be addressed, as these are already criminalised through offences such as assault, attempted murder, and murder, and the use of a weapon and causing wounds, etc., are taken into account in the sentencing of the offender. I think, Chair, what caused a lot of confusion was that, you know, the relationship between the offence of possession of a dangerous weapon and the actual offence like assault being committed with the weapon. The Act needs to address the mere carrying or possession of a weapon under circumstances which indicate that the dangerous weapon is intended to be used for the commission of an offence. So not the actual assault, but the possibility that it can be used and indications that it will be used in an offence. The bill seeks to repeal and substitute all existing legislation regulating dangerous weapons in the Republic with a single piece of legislation applicable to the whole country, to provide for uniform legislation and to prohibit the possession of dangerous weapons in the Dangerous Weapons Act and firearms or replicas or imitation firearms through an amendment of the Firearms Control Act with the intention to use it for an unlawful purpose to commit a crime. So I can just mention there is already such an offence in the Firearms Control Act. What we are doing here is to align the offence in the Firearms Control Act with the offence relating to the carrying of other dangerous weapons other than firearms in this bill. Subject to certain exceptions to prohibit the possession of firearms and objects which resemble firearms through an amendment of the Firearms Control Act and the possession of dangerous weapons and objects likely to cause injury or damage to property at a demonstration or gathering. Chair, you'll realize that if we look at the Constitution, there is actually a prohibition of armed protest gatherings and demonstration. So it's a constitutional principle that we need to give effect to in this legislation. Chair, there was a lot of discussion in the Portfolio Committee regarding the definition of a dangerous weapon. And eventually, especially on insistence of civil society, it was decided to stay with a broad definition which is rather very much the same as in the present Act. And it is defined in Clause 1 as any object other than a firearm capable of causing death or inflicting serious bodily harm if it were used in an unlawful purpose. The reason why firearm is excluded is because it is actually addressed in the Firearms Control Act. Clause 2 provides for exceptions to the application of the Act. And the Act specifically states, and I must say that these exceptions were inserted by the Portfolio Committee, it states that the Act does not apply to the following activities. A, possession of dangerous weapons in pursuit of any lawful employment, duty or activity. Now that will cover like security personnel. B, possession of dangerous weapons during the participation in any religious or cultural activities or lawful sport, recreation or entertainment. Or C, the legitimate collection, display or exhibition of weapons. Clause 3.1 criminalizes the possession of a dangerous weapon under circumstances which may raise a reasonable suspicion that the person intends to use the dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose. Chair, maybe I must explain here that if you look at the present Dangerous Weapons Act, it actually says the person can give a reason in court for the possession possession of the dangerous weapon. The problem with that is that in almost all instances the person might be arrested, and it's only when he appears in court that he can actually put forward a reason why he was in possession of that. Now, this is rectified through the bill by providing that the discretion must be exercised once a police officer finds someone with a dangerous weapon, and then he can expect a reasonable explanation. Of course, you know that in terms of the Constitution, you cannot force a person to give you an explanation. So that is exactly what the bill says. You cannot force a person, but if you want to explain, you must listen to the explanation, you must apply your mind to it, and only then you can decide whether the person is unlawfully in possession of the dangerous weapon and whether it's for an unlawful purpose. Chair, the committee, portfolio committee, was very much intent that there must be factors in the bill. And there were some factors that we placed in the bill before it was published for comments, but there was some expansion on that as well. And those are the factors that must be taken into account in determining whether a person intends to use a dangerous weapon, firearm, replica, or imitation firearm for an unlawful purpose. The place and time where the person is found, the behavior of the person, including the making of any threat or display of intimidatory behavior, the manner in which the object is carried or displayed, whether the possession of the object was within the context of drug dealing, gang association, or any organized crime or any other criminal activity, or any other relevant factors, including any explanation the person may wish to provide for his or her possession or the object, provided that this paragraph shall not be interpreted as an obligation. As I said, the Constitution says you cannot oblige a person to explain himself once being accosted of a crime like this. Chair, I think that because of specifically paragraph E, any other relevant factors actually open the door for a lot of explanations. You know, in Parliament, or I think even in court, it's sometimes difficult to think about all possible situations. But it's about reasonability, and it's about a factor that a person might provide. A person might be in possession of an axe, and you say, I bought this axe, and this is a receipt, I'm taking it home, whatever. There's no intention to use it as a weapon or whatever. Chair, Clause 4 repeals in whole all the existing dangerous weapons acts presently in force in the Republic and the areas which were formerly known as the DBDC states. Chair, then Clause 5 amends the Regulation of Gatherings Act 1993 in order to provide for a prohibition on the possession of air guns, firearms, imitation firearms, muzzle-loading firearms, or any object which resembles a firearm and that is likely to be mistaken for a firearm, and dangerous weapons during gatherings and demonstrations. Chair, the position with firearms is that normally you are able to carry a firearm that's licensed in public. But when it comes to the regulation of gatherings, that during a gathering or demonstration, you're not allowed to carry any weapon. So whether it's a licensed or unlicensed firearm, and that is the reason why that part is not addressed in the Firearms Control Act. The Firearms Control Act say you may carry a firearm that's licensed, it must be concealed and all that. But when it comes to the regulation of gatherings, you're not allowed to carry any weapon during a gathering or a demonstration. Chair, Clause 6 amends the provisions of Section 120 of the Firearms Control Act by extending the existing provisions of subsection 10, which criminalizes the possession of a firearm with the intent to commit an offense, to include an air gun, deactivated firearm, and muzzle-loading firearm. Clause 6 also provides for the factors which can be taken into account in determining whether it's being possessed with intent to commit an offense. So it's really just aligning the provisions of the Firearms Control Act with this type of offense to the provisions on the possession of otherwise a dangerous weapon. Chair, just some background on the history of the bill. The bill was drafted by a task team consisting of officials from both the Department of Police, the Police Service, as well as the Civilian Secretariat, and the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. Public comments were elicited through the publication of the bill in the Gazette. Some 2,300 comments were received. The task teams work closely with the state law advisors in scrutinizing the comments received and in the development of the new draft take into account the comments. The state law advisors certified the bill as being constitutional. And also during the portfolio committee process, there was very close cooperation between the department and the state law advisors. The National Prosecuting Authority also provided comments and made inputs into the bill that were addressed. And in consideration of the bill, the Portfolio Committee on Police invited public comments. The comments were received from, amongst others, the Cape Bar Council, the Security Industry Alliance, the Blade Tool and Sporting Goods Forum, the South African Gun Owners Association, the Gauteng Airsoft Club, the SA Hunters and Game Conservation Association, the SA Catholic Bishops Conference, the Legal Resources Centre, the National Arms and Ammunition Collectors Association, SA Wing Shooters Association and Gun Free South Africa. The Portfolio Committee went through a very thorough process of interrogating these different submissions, also with public hearings. And Chair, we believe that the concerns that have been expressed were actually addressed in the draft before the committee now. The comments that were received led to the following amendments that was made by the Portfolio Committee. Firstly, as I've said, the amendment to the definition of dangerous weapon, the exclusion of certain activities from the Act, to limit the Dangerous Weapons Act to regulating dangerous weapons, and to include an amendment in the Firearms Control Act in respect of the possession of firearms and related objects with the intent to commit an offence, whilst retaining the prohibition of the possession and carrying of all dangerous weapons and firearms and related objects in the regulation of gatherings act. Chair, regarding to the implementation, the Portfolio Committee expected an implementation plan to be submitted by the department. It was done by our operational people. Implemented mission plan was submitted, and the Portfolio Committee indicated that they want the police service on every step of the implementation to report back to the Portfolio Committee. It was also required to submit a cost implementation plan, which was provided to the Portfolio Committee. Chair, the bill is dealt with in accordance with procedures established by Section 75 of the Constitution, since it contains no provision to which the procedure set out in Section 74 or 76 of the Constitution applies. Chair, there was a legal opinion in this regard also obtained from the Chief State Law Advisor's Office, and specifically the issue about traditional weapons that was addressed in the bill to not unnecessarily affect the situation. Chair, it was therefore the conclusion of the State Law Advisors that it's not necessary to refer the bill to the House of Traditional Leaders in terms of Section 18.1A of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, as it doesn't contain provisions pertaining to customary law or customs of traditional communities. This issue was cleared by the Portfolio Committee, and the Parliamentary Law Advisors was satisfied with the deletion of a clause referring to gatherings and demonstrations for cultural purposes. Thank you, Chair. That is basically, we can look at other issues as a committee proceed. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honourable Demande, Honourable Matila.
Yeah. Chair, thanks for the presentation, Chair, and briefing. I come from KZN, Chair. And I think from the general point of view, I disagree with the fact that the legal opinion says that it's a decision is a decision, but I disagree with the contention that this thing doesn't affect traditional weapons or it doesn't need to be sent to the traditional house. You know, Chair, taking what has been presented in the bill in terms of the display of the objects and the definition itself. Now, I'm not too sure if I'm carrying an assegai I've been in IFP rally. I don't know where is this prince here. He's supposed to be here today for this briefing.
Yes. And you remember IFP?
No. But I'm just raising this fact because, you know, sometimes interpretation, some legal people, they are from Cape Town or from Pretoria, not to Matila's integrity from Pretoria. sometimes they decided to take a simplistic view, in my contention. It's a very simplistic view, given the environment of KZN and knowing that environment. Be that as it may, the definition itself, I have a problem with the fact that they are saying, you see, in the definitions at clause one, they are saying other than what firearms contained in what other than. I have a problem of the exclusion of this. And why I have that, because they go, I think in section clause 5-6, they then again go back and refer to the Firearms Controls Act. So to me, it does create some kind of ambiguity. I know it's different matters that are being referred to or being processed in those clauses, but at the top in the definition you exclude it, and then down below you then touch certain things in that act itself. And I'm not sure what the desirability to exclude the weapons is, except to say no, we were tired, or no, we think, because then you would have just imported that definition or cross-reference or refer to it. In the arms code, why would you say you are excluding it completely in the definition? I think it is a matter, Chair, that the committee must clarify itself and find a position in as far as that is concerned. I think I also have clause 3, if you remind me, Chair, I forgot my Braille document. I think in clause 3, they are saying that it's a repeal of those Transkei things, but I have a point there, Chair. They are saying they are repealing all, I'm not sure if it's 3 or 4. Yeah, they are repealing all,
clause 4,
yeah. All other laws are being repealed and what, Chair.
Yeah.
I would like to have made a bit of an elaboration there, Chair, around that matter, because I think what it means when you say just all laws, don't we need to perhaps talk to them if we've done the issues. Number five that talks to the regulation of the gathering.
Yes.
The number three, Chair, let me come back to number three. I think I remember now. Is the discretion issues, isn't it? The issue of the discretion. I think, Chair, we need to clarify the committee, if I remember correctly. I'm on the issue of the discretion. Why? You see, the discretion is given to the police now, I think, to decide whether to arrest the person or not to arrest and all of that. I think it might be subject to abuse. That's the first concern. The second concern is that, perhaps if we are clarified in terms of application of discretion, in matters of decision of arrest and that kind of thing. Because my understanding, Chair, is that of late, I don't know, the major would clarify me, I might miss something, that, you know, generally you'll find that the police, I don't know in which matters, but sometimes the police, they say, no, we are taking the docket to the prosecutor for the prosecutor to decide whether this matter is prosecutable. So in terms of the application of this discretion, it's given powers to the police somewhere, maybe in the Criminal Procedure Act or whatever, check. But I would like a bit of a clarity there. Then I think it's the I do have a concern on the factors themselves, the paragraph, what those factors, that paragraph that deals with the factors. I think the E one, but I'm trying to recall it, but I have an issue there. Maybe I'll come back once I've thought of, but I do have an issue with paragraph with that, but with E on the factors.
It says maybe to remind you, any other relevant factors, including any explanation the person may wish to provide for his or her possession of the object, provided that this paragraph shall not be interpreted as an obligation on the person to explain his or her possession of the object.
Yeah, so you see that means then there should be some means that the police have to use, some measure. So I don't know, Chair. I feel that the bill is placing an unnecessary burden to the police officer. In trying to determine all of this, you know, maybe it's because we are a transformed police service. We no longer say you will answer in court. You know, you will answer in court. Let me take you, you will answer in court. But I think in most of the cases, that's where we are facing problems of sometimes loss of, I mean, not proper thought, arrests, and that kind of thing. I think this clause somehow we need to look at as a committee change in terms of what obligations are placed to this individual officer who would have to, in applying the discretion, but also look into the factors and all of that. So I don't know whether there would be means. Perhaps it would be a matter that would be clarified in the, I don't know if police, they have guides or regulations that they are using in some of this, whether this act will, there would be some guide that will come with it to what which police would understand how to apply this law, because I think it places a lot of burden on the police officer. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think the first point is that possibly, you know, these bills are drafted by lawyers, not ordinary police. And I think the first problem is that they don't think.
Hello.
Oh, I'm just saying they don't think for those ordinary police. Because they want them to think as themselves as lawyers. Because you see the first problem that is being raised, that's why I want to agree with Member Lo. The interpretation of the first year. All gatherings, starting from those ages to date, the Americana situation is a very clear case where there was clear misinterpretation of and people don't understand whether they were carrying dangerous weapons, whether it was these traditional weapons, whether it was what. You know, police had to interpret it. They also had to deal with a lot of other factors where even the most senior policemen could not, because it does not have those particulars. Now, the issue of placing that burden on the police officers, this is a serious problem. That
Second, I think the disadvantage we have as a committee is that we don't have the benefit of the issues raised by the submissions that we've got. The Catholic Bishops Conference, Legal Resource Center, we have, you know, all those groupings. What are the issues? How do they deal with this particular bill? You know, and the issues raised by the portfolio committee itself when they reach whatever decision in changing whatever, because it is clear to me if they had to come with some amendments in as far as all the changes around the, what is a dangerous weapon, you know, what do you mean? You know, because, you know, I know sometimes that even a cup, it was stated to us, I don't know when, that at some point even a teacup can become a dangerous weapon depending on what is that you're using it for. And that's what was stated to us, you see. Now, how does that officer interpret that situation? Because in most cases, all these things were interpreted by either the prosecutors, whether to proceed or whatever, you know. And that is the situation. I thought, because we are almost at the towards the end, we will be given some of the issues raised by those copies by the department itself, because we did not have we did not have access to that. We were not part of that particular process. I thought that is going to assist us to deal with some of the issues. And that is the other point that I wanted to raise. Let me also agree with the honourable member here that I'm not sure what was the reason and why this decision for not having any consultation or having taking this matter to traditional to the traditional house. Have you consulted with traditional leadership? No. If not, I'm not sure why. Because at the end of the day, it also takes me to this particular point, that the majority of the people that have made submissions comes from a specific class, and not even people that will be affected by some by most of the changes that comes on board here, and as far as this legislation is concerned, or this particular bill, or other legislations that are there that you're saying you're trying to even change, the Firearm Act and whatever, you know, so that you bring those things in line and also make those necessary changes there, you know. Now, I'm just saying ordinary people, and because I know in most cases, if you come to such situations, it is only, and in most cases, because when we say we have consulted, We don't consult with the broad society, but we consult with that specific class. And then that's where the problem is. Those people are not affected, but what happens on the ground. You know? And that is the situation. And maybe and that's the reason why I ask, as to what is the reason why you have not consulted with traditional leaders themselves. Chair? I'll rest my case.
You can respond.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, as I've said, the initial bill was published in the Government Gazette for public comments to absolutely anybody who want to respond. I must say, when the responses were received, it was very much as the member has said, particular. I was actually amazed that previously a lot of things were about traditional weapons, etc., but the responses we received were actually, I would say about 90% about them were about these little spray cans that you use for tear gas and that type of stuff. And people who thought that intention of the bill is to totally disarm people, and so it was very, if I can say, political in that regard. Chair, I think the submissions from the different parties, or that they're not parties but the different institutions from civil society, were very much related to their core functions. The Cape Bar Council gave a general overview about the issues about the definition, etc. The Security Industry Alliance, of course, related to security office and officers, and as I've said, that there is an exception that when it relates to a Section 2, relates to the pursuit of any lawful employment duty or activity that was addressed. The Gauteng Airsoft Club, they were just concerned about the transport, etc., of air guns, etc., to participate in their sports. The Hunters and Game Conservation Association, very much the same concern. When they go out hunting, etc., they were concerned that they will be accosted and arrested. And that's what I say, where the interaction between the Firearms Control Act, this act, becomes very important. If you have a hunting rifle with you, it's in the correct bag, you have your license with you, etc., etc., there's no way, and they were concerned that, for example, if a group of them were driving together to go for hunting exercise, that they may be accosted and arrested in terms of this legislation. The Catholic Bishops' Conference as well was more a general overview, also with reference to the definition. The Legal Resources Center, very much the same. The National Arms and Ammunition Collectors Association, they were concerned about issues when they have, like, exhibition of firearms at public places. I recall recently there was such an exhibition at the National War Museum in Johannesburg. Now, they need permits, they need a lot of, in terms of the Firearms Control Act. And they were concerned, and I think their concerns, they were satisfied after the meeting. The Winchesters Association, once again, the same concerns as the Hunters. Chair, but I think the committee listened to all this, and I think the end product, I think most of these people were satisfied with the outcome and the, especially the application and the exceptions. And Chair, once again, if I can relate to the relationship between the two acts. If I'm walking in the street and I have a licensed firearm in my possession, I carry it according to the Firearms Control Act. There's nothing else that regulates it. But once I'm participating in a public protest, totally other rules become applicable. The Constitution becomes applicable. And the member referred to the issue about Marikana, for example. Gee, I think it's actually a pity that in our country the Constitution dates back to 1996. But every day we see public protests where people are armed, whether it's with sticks or knives or whatever. This issue was discussed in the Portfolio Committee, and we really say, Gee, I think there's also a process that needs to take place in public, of awareness of legislation, awareness of this type of thing. But if you have a protest action, you're not supposed to be armed. Then again, the police is sometimes in a very difficult situation. To disarm a group of 2,000 or 5,000 people is sometimes not easy. It can actually be more disastrous to try and disarm them than to rather, if they do not commit violence, etc., to photograph it. And in terms of the Act, you can prosecute people who are armed during, even in terms of our present legislation. If people are armed during protest, then you can photograph them. If you can identify them, you can later prosecute them. But as I've said, that's a situation that the commander on the ground has to deal with in terms of how the crowd behaves, etc., etc. But here, if I look at our Constitution, it's the main law in our land. It's all our other laws are subject to the Constitution. It says that if you are protesting, if it's a protest gathering or a demonstration, you're not supposed to be armed. That is the bottom line of our Constitution. So our legislation needs to reflect that. And that is the reason why we refer in the Regulation of Gatherings Act. At the moment, the Regulation of Gatherings Act just have a cross-reference to the Dangerous Weapons Act. But now, if you read the Regulation of Gatherings Act, you will see in the Regulation of Gatherings Act, these are the perimeters if you have a protest, gathering, or demonstration of things that may not be carried. That includes firearms, it includes something that looks like a firearm, it includes any other dangerous weapon. So we think in terms of also the application of legislation, and we're thinking about our members as well. If you have the Regulation of Gatherings Act in your hand, as it is amended through this Act, you know exactly what, how to deal with the with protest gatherings in terms of weapons, etc., etc. But Chair, I'm in agreement with the member. It is so. We, every day we see on television people protesting and they are armed. In terms of our constitution, it should not be so. The problem, as the member rightly say, is for the police to deal with that situation. It is problematic, and I think it's one of the worst nightmares we as police have, because we are supposed to protect the lives of other people. Even amongst the group, we are supposed to protect the life of everyone, and you have to keep that balance. And I think when it comes to protest gatherings, I think it's one of the most difficult areas to police. But if we as police do not have the mechanisms in terms of legislation saying nobody is supposed to be armed when they participate in these gatherings, I think we are even worse off. I think we are really worse off, because that's what our constitution says. If the legislation doesn't fit into that, it will really create a much bigger problem for the police. Chair,
because I know the focus is on protest, you know, but in terms of certain cultures and traditions, you know, it also deals with celebrations, you know. How do you deal, because they carry this thing during celebrations, and I think how do you deal with that situation, because that must assist them, because I know in terms of protest here, yes, but the reason why we are using the cultural aspect is because of celebrations, because of what, and anything can happen there. Anything can happen there. How do you deal with that particular situation? And that's the point we wanted to address. And I think what you two have to explain to us.
Chair, if you agree, if my colleagues want to also fill in, if it carries your blessing, I would appreciate their comments as well. But from my side, if you look at the Regulation of Gatherings Act, it is directed at a protest gathering. In other words, a wedding would not fall within that category of a gathering that's regulated in terms of the Regulation of Gatherings Act. And also, you know, Chair, we have the new sports legislation, which also deal with a number of events that's covered in terms of that act. But if you look at weddings, and I think that is where the issue of the traditional weapons became vague in this thing, because it's really not intended on that situation, because it relates, it says, what is excluded is any lawful activity, etc. A wedding is a lawful activity. It's not regulated in terms of the Regulation of Gatherings Act. So, but once again, should people start stabbing each other at the wedding, etc., the police will, of course, be able to, but as I've said in the beginning, Chair, there are offences such as murder, attempted murder, assault to commit grievous bodily harm, etc. So even if there's just a threat with a weapon, there are offences in terms of which we can act. But the intention of the Regulation of Gatherings Act is not at all to relate to that type of social activity like a wedding. Chair, I don't know, maybe on this point my colleagues want to add on it, then I shall continue with the other concerns that members have raised. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Chair. I think the question is a valid one, but in the crafting of the bill, this is where the factors just provided for in clause sub 2 comes in. The key there, the intention in which the object is used. And the intention is not to prohibit bona fide events like weddings, consular events, etc., because they're the factors and the intention comes in. And I think there's a reason why that provision was inserted to cater for this kind of, in addition to what General has said.
Thank you, Chief.
Blue. Just a moment.
Honorable Blue.
Thank you, Chair. Relating to the traditional leaders, I really think there was no intention from our side to, you know, to skip them or to say we don't want to consult with them or anything. There was a concern in the portfolio committee with the previous wording of the bill that it might relate to the cultural weapon issue. But that related to a prohibition that was placed in the Regulation of Gatherings Act and which was actually out of place. And the state law advisors advised us to take it out. And in that regard, it then was very clear that the House of Traditional Leaders, that there is no overlap with this Act in terms of that concern that was raised. And I think the Portfolio Committee was very conscious of the possibility. And that is why it gave specific attention to the issue. Chair, when it comes to the definition, I think the explanation that was given previously as well is, you know, if I'm walking with this bottle down the street, carrying it like this, nobody can say I'm in possession of a dangerous weapon. But if I take this bottle and it would be a glass one and I eat it, and I start pointing at people, whatever, I'm surely I'll be in possession of a dangerous weapon. It's quite obvious that I want to commit an offence with it. Chair, I think that's a difficulty we have in terms of definition here. Any object can really be a dangerous weapon. You know, if you read some of these stories during the Second World War, lady spies would have like a long hair needle and they would just push it in someone's ear. You will die immediately. Anything can really be a dangerous weapon. So, the Act went back to the basics to say what, from the behavior of the person, what is the intention the person has with that object. And that is where even we actually try to limit the definition. And from civil society side, they say, no, anything can be a weapon. It depends on what is the intention. And that is where we link onto the issue of intention and how do you guide the police officer to be able to exercise his or her discretion? Because I agree with the members what have been said here. You know, it's a very difficult task to give to a police officer. And I think that's something we see every day, whether it's with an arrest is just a serious matter as anything else. But the police officer has to exercise his or her discretion. If it's this type of offense, if it's these circumstances, I can arrest the person without a warrant. And the criteria used for the exercising of this discretion is very much the same as with the deciding on whether an arrest must take place, irrespective of what the specific offence is. Chair, so I don't think, unless we go back to the model of the existing Act, to say the person can go and explain in court. We want to prevent that situation. We want a situation where the person is given the opportunity. Whether the person wants to, we cannot oblige him to make use of that opportunity. But we feel we must give the person the opportunity to give an explanation why he's in possession of that. And as I said, it's not only the explanation that's relevant, it's the other factors as well. What is the time? If I find someone within my plot where I'm living, and there's wires around and electric fence or whatever, the person is inside there. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and the person has a knife in his possession. Will it not be different from a person walking in a street with a small pocket knife in his pocket, doing nothing to nobody? And I think that is the general idea, is to lay down some guidance for a police officer. And we really made an open invitation in the committee as well. If any member can add
to those guidelines, we will be happy from the police side, because we also do not want unnecessary civil actions for unlawful arrest and all that. So we really try to give some guidance, Chair, to the police officer to exercise his discretion to avoid the situation that you arrest a person and the first opportunity he has to explain himself, he's only in court. Chair, it was mentioned about the legislation that's been repealed. Chair, I can say that basically all the pieces of legislation that's proposed to be repealed is more or less the same. There might be very slight differences between the TDDC states, between the pieces of legislation, but it basically was the South African legislation that was made applicable in those areas. Now, rationalization is exactly that, to repeal the old legislation applicable only in parts of the country and to get a single act that will apply to the whole of the South Africa. So what is in here cover those issues in terms of the subject matter. And we have to repeal those acts because that's exactly what the Constitutional Court said to us. We can't have different acts and laws. The police must apply one single law across the board. And this is exactly, and Chair, I think if there are members who were here in 1996, that's exactly what we did with the rationalization of security legislation. All the old terrorism legislation in the TDDC states were repealed, and one just specific sections were made applicable of the Internal Security Act, which later on we also repealed and came with the terrorism legislation. So, Chair, that is the purpose of rationalization, is to delete everything that's old on the law book and put something new in its place. And that is really the only relevance of Clause 4 with the repeal of those pieces of legislation. Chair, I don't know whether I've answered everything. If I trust so, but if there's anything, I'll really try and assist.
Honourable Matilda and Honourable Bloom.
Yeah, just the concern about the example that has been given to us, because that might mean most of the youth, particularly boys, when sent to a shop to buy, when buy cauldron, might be arrested in the way. Because you see, a 1.25 litre of cauldron can't be carried this way. You understand how big it is. And if you carry it this way, might create a lot of problems. I'm just saying, those examples you need to be very careful in doing. Because, you know, each time if a person carries, particularly if there are people in front of you, the interpretation may be different from the police officer, you see, as to, because you don't know what the intention is, and that person might be arrested. I'm just saying that example, you know. And I was just referring to the body. Yeah, because that's how... the example was given to us, and I became worried. You see, thank you, Chair. I was just questioning that around the examples that I given to us.
Chair, if I remember correctly, I said if it's broken, and I think that's the difference. If you break a bottle, you're not going to hand it in at the shop or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Hello, Bloom.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I'm having a some questions for clarification. You see, on three, and I think Member Louis tried to ask this question, but you see, this clause is saying, I want to understand this reasonable suspicion. You know, I'm very much worried that it's very broad, Chair, in saying reasonable suspicion. Who is going to determine that reasonable suspicion? That's the first one. On the same one, cultural activity is not, you see, we want clarification. What is it? Cultural activity. Maybe if they can and also what constitute recreation? Chair, I will ask follow up questions, but this is just part of the clarification. I will continue, maybe if they respond.
Yes, they can respond.
Yeah.
Chair, cultural activity, I think that would include something like a wedding. Sport, recreation, very near to each other. If you take, for example, a person who do spear fishing in the sea, that spear gun can be regarded as a dangerous weapon if it's used or abused or with intent to injure someone. But that is the type of thing that, if I can go to sports, for example, if you would find a boy walking to the sports field or to the school with one of these javelins, if you would chase people with that javelin in the street, it might become a dangerous weapon. But well, if he's going to exercise his sport and whatever, and that is the type of explanation that would be applicable in this instance. On the question being asked about the reasonable suspicion, Chair, if you would go to the Criminal Procedure Act, you will find that is also the criteria for that a police officer must use in most instances where an arrest is being considered. Now, reasonable suspicion is something that must be objectively tested at the end of the day. So a court will look at what is reasonable to the if I can say, the average person. What is reasonable in the circumstances? And I think that is the test for all these issues here. If the police officer would apply his mind, the question is, will the objective, reasonable person come to the same conclusion that that person wanted to use or intended to use this weapon as a dangerous weapon? Chair, that is really as far as I can take it. As I said, the problem we have is that we cannot postpone the decision on an arrest or not until the time that the person is in court. That is totally unreasonable to the person. And I think that is one part of the existing act that if it would go to the Constitutional Court, that we will actually have problems with. But what the court did, it interpreted in practice the existing legislation not to expect that a person, in other words, if a person can give a reason to the police officer, it must be taken into account, etc. So the court had some interpretation which was helpful in terms of going forward without changing the legislation. But I think if just on the wording of the present act, you actually end up in problems in terms of the sort of it's like a fiction that's being created, that you actually take the guilt of the person even before the person is being prosecuted. Thank you, Chair.
Hello, Mr. Mandy.
Chair, I asked about, you know, I hope the state law advisors would have this discretion is built in this book, and I said it might be a simple question of ignorance in terms of the application of the discretion. I think the reasonable suspicion has been explained quite well in terms of the test that the courts apply in determining, you know, whatever they want to determine. But in terms of this discretion that is given to the police officer, who, you know, we needed to hear something around that issue. And I hope the state law advisors would assist as well to in terms of
of the training of police officers. Some of the areas you are building into this legislation or these bills, is that part of the training? Because you see, that will then assist us to have an understanding, because it takes us to, because we are worried about the entry level, we are worried about the lowest level. It might be that those that are not on the streets are in offices might understand what to do, but those that are on the streets might not understand what to do, you know? And that's where the problem is.
Hello, Blue Blue.
Chairperson, thank you very much. 2E. 2E. Any other relevant factors? This person must now explain to the police. Now, my question is, does this clause not, is it not in conflict with the Constitution that this person remain silent, provided by the Constitution of the country? The clarity.
Yes, we can respond to that. Thank you, Chair. Chair, now what the member said about training is very, very relevant and important. And that is really in terms of the implementation plan. It's crucial to the whole implementation of the Act. And there's provision that the once Parliament has approved the bill, that we will actually start with the training program, because I think it was a concern that really was expressed across the board, also in the Portfolio Committee, was a concern about how the discretion. It was really, I would say, 70% of our discussions was about the exercising of discretion. Exactly what we are listening to today is really, and I can understand it, because I think that's many times where things go wrong, is in the street, where the action happens, where the decision is made, and the wrong decision is made, with detrimental effect also to the police's budget, etc. So it is a very crucial part of the implementation plan that there really must be a proper training and also communication. Not communication only to the police service and police members, but also to the community. Like I said, in respect of public marches and gatherings and demonstrations, and the whole issue about the whole impact of the bill, that must be explained also to the public, but mainly to police officers, to know what are the limits, what has changed from the old Act to the new Act. And really that is the crux of the whole matter. Chair, relating to Mr. Bloom's question, if I read paragraph E fully, any other relevant factors, including any explanation the person may wish to provide for his or possession of the object, provided that this paragraph shall not be interpreted as an obligation on the person to explain his or her possession of the object. So, Chair, we wanted to really force the police official to grant an opportunity to the person to explain himself. But we cannot force the member of public to explain himself. Like Mr. Bloom said, that would be against the Constitution. So we can provide that opportunity, but we cannot, and the Act is very clear, that there is no obligation to explain yourself. So, Chair, we discussed that with the State Law Advisors, and they were happy that we provide the opportunity to give an explanation without putting an unconstitutional obligation on the member of the public. Thank you, Chair.
Now, Chair, why are we including this paragraph here? If this person, if Dennis, is can't be forced to explain, why do we have this in here?
Yeah, that's I'm covered with the first point. But second, Chair, if this person can't explain, you know, and it also limits what discretion that police officer, because if he explains, you know, it becomes much more easier to deal with that. But also then there's a burden on this particular person, you know, in dealing with the constitution of the country, you know. I'm just saying, you know, how is this balanced out? How is this balanced out? Because it would be unfair for him to explain himself, because that would be used against him in court. You see? And if he does not, you know, this police officer is limited in because he can't take a decision that might assist the situation on the ground. Now, why is the reasoning of offering this clause in?
Let me put another point. How will this thing work? There's a disabled person, deaf, is deaf or is blind. But now this person, he has a cultural weapon or whatever. How, you know, we must have this clear explanation on what is going to happen when we approve this.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think if we look at the putting of it in here, let's take a crime like possession of suspected stolen goods. The Constitutional Court has found it's not unconstitutional to ask an explanation from the person. That person as well can decide he's not going to give you any reason, which might lead to the fact that you will then have to arrest the person. The same with this. The Act is leaving the opportunity for the person to explain himself. And I think that in most instances where a person has a totally valid and lawful reason why he or she is in possession of that object, will really give it to a police officer. But I can't say that if a person do not give a reason that he's guilty. And I think that is where the rest of the provisions A, B, C, D also are applicable. What is the time of the day or night? Where is the person? What are the circumstances? Etc. Chair, I totally agree with all members. It is a difficult situation. And really, I think our members are every day in a situation where they have to make this type of decisions, which impact on people's rights, which impact on their freedom, etc. On the other hand, I think we as a community cannot allow that any person just carry anything under any circumstances, you know, and have nothing regulating this. The same with the Constitution. As I've said, we have the obligation in the Constitution saying that if you protest, it must be unarmed. Now, we have to give effect to that. How difficult it is sometimes. But, Chair, I want to say there were some observations, you know, that we sit maybe in Pretoria and so on. I grew up in the Eastern Cape. I don't want to dissociate myself with Pretoria, but, you know, we really try this legislation and we go into court cases over many years and see how the previous legislation was interpreted. We made comparative legal studies in other countries. And I must tell you, if you look at the United Kingdom, It is as if there's a mockery made of the legislation on dangerous weapons. If you go to a cutlery shop and there's knives and forks there, there will be a sign. Not for sale for people under 18 years. And all that type. Even if you're like me as the voortrekkers, the young chappies, they have the Boy Scouts, they're not allowed to take pen knives when they go camping and whatever. So in many countries, and you will find there were discussions about toy guns and whatever the possession thereof. You will find that in many countries, a toy gun, for example, must have a colored point, say orange or red or whatever. So we are not the only country who look at these things. And I think if we look at the number of violent crimes being committed in our country, we cannot even ignore this issue. We have to give attention to it. And Chair, If I must convey what came from the provinces when we communicated this legislation for comments, the provincial people really want strong legislation to attend to this. But once again, when we look at this from a macro perspective, we need to take into account the Constitution and all these other matters. But I really think, Chair, we really tried to balance off all these interests. And I must say from my side, I think it was one of the most difficult pieces of legislation that we have dealt with. We went over and over with the state law advisors and with research and so on. And I think what we came up and also with the assistance from Parliament side, and the interaction that took place here, I really think we tried to do the best we could in the circumstances. But, Chair, I think all the questions that were asked here were totally relevant, exactly the same things that also bothered, and which I trusted and hope that we have tried to address. Thank you very much.
No, Matila.
Chair, I think one thing that we must never forget is the past we're coming from, whilst we presently, we're still living in this specific past. Because I'm just saying, just recently, whilst dealing with this legislation, you know, for explaining himself, who he is, why is he at the police station, and all those different producing evidence to that effect, he got himself punched, that lawyer. You know, that's the recent thing, you see. And that's why we're worried about all this. And that seems to be a senior police officer, I'm not sure, you know. But that is the situation, for absolutely nothing. Now, if you take that part, because if you take what is happening, you take Pretoria because you're working there. There's an area in Pretoria. We were black officers are not even allowed to enter that specific area, you know. What might happen there, you know. And the station commander there, he's not doing anything else towards that particular, or to deal with that particular situation, but he seems to be collaborating, you know. And I'm just saying, this is the past we've been living with, these are the situations, and we come with legislation. How is that legislation going to, because here, somebody was raising an issue, we're dealing with something else yesterday, you know, that how does this legislation assist us in terms of transformation, you know? How does it, because our understanding as politicians is to how do we transform society, you know, how do we deal out, because you're not telling us, you know, that is one situation, because if it has to transform the police force, it has to transform, assist to transform society and all those things, and these are experiences, practical experiences, issues that we experience on a daily basis on the ground, you know. And is this legislation not going to further a badly impact on those societies or whatever? We are not sure. And that's the reason why we're asking all these questions. Thank you, Chief.
Honorable Bloom. Did you want to respond? I think there were many examples. If I remember correctly as well, even some of the sports people
they use like these BB type of guns. It doesn't shoot a real bullet, it's a plastic gun, whatever. But they say no, if they're driving at night with camouflage uniforms on and whatever. So the chairperson said, look, I don't think it's a good idea during night time, even if you have plastic guns and things with you, to drive around with camouflage jackets. It's things you can put on when you're there playing your sport and things, and when you come back, you put on other clothes again. So I think there were many of those arguments, you know, in real life situations. And this thing is really, as I said, it really becomes complicated if you look at all the aspects and all the interests and so on. But Chair, I think our interest is really the interest of people who are threatened, the danger that it poses. And I think what the member says about change in society, it's really important. And what we see as what must take place in society is that people know they can protest. It's in terms of the constitution, it's your right to protest. But if you take part in a public protest, you're not supposed to be armed. You're not supposed to threaten other people through what you're doing. But as a collective, as a group, you can really show society this is what we stand for, this is what we want, etc., etc. But do it in an unarmed fashion. But I hear what the members say, you know, we are in a process of transformation, and things are interpreted sometimes. As I said, this act, this bill, elicited a response from an area where we didn't thought it will come from. But nevertheless, it was interesting, Jay, but I think what we are sitting with, the Constitutional Court said we must now rationalize this act. We must come forward with a piece of legislation that can be used across the board, the same legislation for the whole country, and of course it must be constitutional. And I think that's the one thing that we can always be tested on, and the state law advisors was in agreement that they think that the provisions as we have it here, that they will be constitutional. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm very much interested to know what prompted this. What prompted this? You see, because there's culture involved here, there's a lot of things. If I can get, you see what Member Matila is asking, and the general is responding to say, yes, transformation and all. What? This thing is going to hamper transformation, because you are now encroaching in people's cultural activities and whatever. You must give explanation. Basut, they are there with knopkilis dancing, and if I am from that activity and I'm going alone in the street with that knopkilis, it's a dangerous weapon, most. I must, and the police meet me, I must now give explanation. I'm alone now. It's no more in that activity, in that gathering. I'm alone. You see, it's a very complicated issue.
Do you want to comment, sir?
Chair, no, I mean, to say that if it is a protest and you're participating in the protest, of course, within that context, it will be illegal. But if the person is walking alone, you will have to judge it on the circumstances, in those circumstances. But I don't think I can add much further to that. Thank you, Chair.
No, I think there's been criticisms of the definition, but just on, I must call you Honourable Member Bloom and not... A dangerous weapon means any object other than a firearm capable of causing death or inflicting serious bodily harm. And this is where the importance, if it were used for an unlawful purpose. So if you use for a lawful purpose and if you're walking down the street. But I hear the other side of the argument in terms of transformation of the police, the ability of the police to exercise discretion. But if it was used for an unlawful purpose, then the act kicks in.
Yes, honourable members, after the engagement.
The Khoisan is safe.
He's not here. Not
Chair, no, I don't think we do have further engagement, but I think it is important that the department, whilst we'll be looking at this particular bill, trying to process it, some of the issues that has been raised, it will be important for the department to look at them. I mean, just the last example, if you link that to our own past and whatever, you know, if you get across a group, but now say old Afrikaner policemen who are not experiencing the force, and get that particular person, they'll arrest him. They'll arrest him for, even if he explains, they don't even want to listen to that, you know, and that causes a lot of other unnecessary tensions and problems. Around that specific area. How about that person going back and explaining to that particular clan as to what is happening? Then you're causing a rift between those two communities, you see, which is a problem. I'm just saying, let's think about this situation. Let's make sure that we I'm not sure whether there's something that can be changed, there's something that, but I'm just saying, let's think about it. That might assist in terms of the training. That might assist in terms of something else, even if the view is left that way. I'm just saying, let's just think. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much, honorable members. This brings us to the end of the meeting. The meeting is adjourned.